Welcome back to another episode of NTNU's International Taiwan Studies Centre podcast. I'm your host, Josh, and today I'm pretty excited because we have Professor Scott Simon, who is professor at the School of Sociological and Anthropological Studies at the University of Ottawa in Canada, right here with us in Taipei. Now, Scott, welcome to you. I know you've been researching Taiwan for many years, and actually you've written four books on Taiwan already. But could you fill us in on what you've been doing most recently? That would be great to catch up on what you've been up to.
Okay, that's fine. So most recently, I've been working on a project called Austronesian Worlds, Human-Animal Entanglements in the Pacific Anthropocene.
Okay.
Lots of big words in that title, I know. But basically, it's a very large grant. It's a project within which different professors and graduate students create their own research projects. And so within that, I do human-bird relations. I had an MA student on Orchid Island who was interested in garbage, plastic. And so she wrote about the ocean plastic pollution.
Okay.
I had another student who went to Guam, where there are also Austronesian people, and he took an interest in, first of all, in the mangroves.
Okay.
But then in the relationship with the U.S. military on Guam and the Chamorro people.
Right.
And so we'll see what comes out of that. So we've had colleagues and graduate students going around from Kunming, that one of them went to China, and Japan, the Philippines. And so it's been quite interesting to have these dialogues. As for my own contribution, I did a year of fieldwork in Japan.
Okay.
And now I did 2 months of fieldwork in Guam before COVID hit, and I had to leave. I came back to Taiwan for the first 4 months of the COVID. And then this year I have the final year of the grant, which was delayed because of COVID. The final year I get to spend in Taiwan. And I've done comparative work in, first of all, in Tainan, in Chiku, which is also, Tainan is where I did my PhD research, so it's a familiar place. And then the second one was Orchid Island, which again is a familiar place.
Okay.
And then in these days now, I've been working with the Sejik Turugu. That gets a bit more complicated to people who aren't into it because it doesn't follow the administrative borders in Taiwan so neatly.
Sure.
So I'm talking about people who live in Nantou and Hualien. And I started out in Nantou, and now I'm on my way to Hualien to finish that. And then I'll go briefly to Mabzu.
Right.
As the fourth site.
Okay.
And then I'll go back to Canada at the end of June.
Right. And then how long do you think it would take you to compile all of your findings?
Well, I hope that it doesn't take as long as my last book did. When I started writing that one in 2016, in Heidelberg as a visiting scholar.
Yeah.
And I just finished it in 2023 was when it got published. So I don't want to see a six-year process. I would like to get it done more quickly.
Yeah.
It really depends on how the writing goes and how many interruptions there are. But also, I have no idea. I mean, we cannot really know how much time we need to write a book. It's going to be a shorter book than The Truly Human. Mm. But nonetheless, it's going to be an ethnography of human-bird relations from Hokkaido to Orchid Island. And I'll have to figure out the logical order to put that in to tell the story I want to tell.
Yeah.
And pick out the stories I want to tell about particular birds in particular places.
Oh, that's fascinating. So, I mean, it's interesting. You have a lot of, obviously, data and observational and scientific stuff, and yet there's a lot of creativity involved in actually trying to turn it into the story and answer.
Yeah. My perspective on anthropology is that it's very much on the border of social science and the humanities.
Mm.
And this particular project is clearly in the environmental humanities.
Okay.
And so it's not a scientific project at all in the sense of going and testing out hypotheses. I kind of like to call it a phenomenological approach.
Sure.
Where we put ourselves in situations and then we simply let the world unfold in front of us, and we learn what we can, and we write it down, and we take photos and so forth, and then we have stories to tell.
Yeah.
And so there is definitely a creative writing element that's very strong.
Yeah. In terms of the previous book, we're talking about Truly Human, indigeneity and indigenous surgeons, Formosa.
Uh-huh.
And would it be fair to say that was kind of like a culmination of a lot of work in around on Taiwan? Do you think you could summarize what it was that sparked something in you to write that book, kind of compile all of this experience? And what was it that made you think there's a book
here? Yeah, so it's compiling 20 years of experience, basically, from when I was a part-time teacher at Donghua University and met Tian Cunzhao, who got me interested in the Asia Summit case.
Okay.
So that began in the year 2000.
Right.
And then I continued going back there until 2020, those first months of the pandemic. And then I went back to Canada, and that's really when things got started on the book. But in those 20 years, there was one conversation that really stuck out. You know, that's what we do, is we have conversations with people. But there's one that really stuck out in my memory. And so it was one that I thought this would make a good kernel of a book. And what it was is that in 2007, as the SEDEC in Nantou were going through the process of name rectification, and they wanted to get recognized as an indigenous people. And I supported that. I wrote even an essay about why that is consistent with international and domestic law, and that every indigenous people has the right to determine their own identity.
Yeah.
So I was very much in support of that. But I also had to know the dissidents within the community. And there was one elder man, and he said to me, he said, did you see all of these flags around the village saying Saidekutsu, Sedek people?
Yeah.
I avoid the word tribe. I think that's pejorative, but Sedek people. And he said, do you see all those flags? He said, this is ridiculous. Sedek means human being. It's too narrow to say that this ethnic group of, it's like 32,000 people, represents all of humanity. That's ridiculous. He said, you are human. I'm human. We're all human. It means something else. And so I started an exploration of what does it mean to be human. And so I'm writing a book. This is why I said you never know how long it takes. You know, the first years of writing it, I was delving into cognitive anthropology and how humans move through the world and perceive the world and so forth. But it ended up being more of a dialogue with indigenous authors. So I call it the indigenous resurgence, or this cultural resurgence, because there was really good writing done by Sedek authors.
Presumably that wasn't just one elder who was saying this is a bit ridiculous.
Right. He represents basically that particular generation of people, about what they felt about this. And the Japanese called them Ataya. They speak a language which is significantly different from the other Ataya dialects, but the thing is they all have their different dialects.
Yes.
And so some of them had gotten used to that and didn't see the need to create something new. And I think that there was a perception among many people in the village, and this happened when Tai Luka was getting theirs in 2004 as well. I think it happened in all of them, is that there were some people who didn't see the need for it. And they perceived that there were certain elites among their community who were using this for their own political or financial advantage. And so there was this perception. But in the book, and I get into this, this man who was dissenting from that was basing his perceptions and his understanding in the Sedek Gaya, which is a basic ethical moral framework that often gets translated as law.
Yeah.
But what I also get to is that those people who were promoting Sedek are also acting in accordance with Gaia.
Okay.
And so they all are. They're all... Yeah. They're all aiming for the same good in their different ways. And so I saw a need to engage with that issue. So what is Gaia? What is the good? What does it mean to be human, to be truly human? Because they say there's that movie, you know, The Warriors of the Rainbow. The name in Chinese is Saideko Balai.
That's right.
Which means Sejek Balai, truly human or a true human.
Which is really interesting because as a movie goer, that's not something that jumps out at you. But there's so much depth behind this, explaining, which as the average person like me, I had no idea. I guess there's such a level of importance that comes with that depth that makes your, for example, your writing this book actually really
significant, because if indigenous people are going to be treated as mm-hmm. really human,
mm-hmm.
we need to understand that,
right,
and kind of take off some of these perspectives mm-hmm. that we get of either the kind of primitive
mm-hmm.
idea, or it's the rose-tinted, you know, the perfectly uh-huh. environmental and
right.
to follow everything uh-huh. kind of thing. So I think that exploration mm-hmm. of what is Gaia, that
uh-huh.
I mean, it might sound, if you don't know anything about it, slightly abstract, but this feels to me like there's such a depth of importance mm-hmm. in there that yeah. actually for the rest of us to understand yeah. would be so beneficial.
Yeah, that's why I had to write a book about that.
Yeah.
And I was lucky in a way that he waited us. I made this film, you know, 11 years after I started doing my research with these people.
Yeah.
And I found it humorous that people suggested to me that because of my, you know, 11 years to 10, making of it, you know, 9 to 10 years of experience doing research with these people, that I could be an advisor to him. And I said, that's absolutely ridiculous, because I know very well who he's working with. He's working with the same people that I consulted to learn about Gaia, right?
Yeah.
So there's no reason to go through me as a third party. He's already going to the best experts. And I would, you know, that's why the book is there. It's a dialogue with some of these authors, like Dagi Spawa, who is a graduate here of this university. But he was a very critical scholar and very good at understanding what this is about. And he's got several books he's written about the film and what they got wrong. But I think that the film got a lot of things right as well. And it is a very deep film, and it's worth watching again and again and again. It seems so bloody and gory, I think that turns people off, but it is a very deep film with so many different layers of meaning that we can go into.
Yeah. Something you've talked about is how attention to animals during fieldwork mm-hmm. research
mm-hmm.
provides new insights into political relations mm-hmm. between humans.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you could explain that a little bit more? Because again, I think there's some really fascinating things in there.
Yeah. So I think what I'll do is I'll explain that first with dogs.
Sure.
And then we'll go into the birds, which is a little bit more complex in some ways.
Okay.
But actually, when I went to Anak Bualo, which is a Durugu village that belongs to the Sedek people, mm-hmm. they're already getting some complexities of ethnic politics there, but they speak Durugu and they belong to the Sedekutu, right? And they're right up on the ridge of the mountain, and going down, you're in the Hualien area. I mean, they're very close there. And there were dogs everywhere. And during the day, when people were busy with their tea fields, their tea plantations, I was in the village kind of waiting for people to come back. And while I was there, I started watching what the dogs were doing.
A bit of a legal question. Huh? Are these domestic dogs, or were they wild?
That's what the whole article turned out to be.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. Because domestication would be that, and you know, the word domus means the home, right?
Yes.
So it's kind of the idea that they live in the home, and domestication involves the element that the humans control their reproduction.
Okay.
But these are free roaming dogs who know where they belong. And I took notes and watched them, and I never fed them.
Okay.
There was no food involved at all. But because of the attention that I was giving them, with my eyes, they started to take an interest in me, and they started following me around everywhere I went. And so I got to understand which dogs live where they go to eat at night, because they all go back to their homes at night. They do have homes with people. And I talked to people about these dogs, because I would go visit them in their homes, and the dogs would follow me. And then I would knock on the door, and they'd invite me in and laugh because their dog's on the street following me. And then I'd go inside, and the dogs know that they cannot go inside strangers' homes. And then when I'm done talking to people, I'd come back out, and the dogs would just continue down the street with me, right? And they all found it very humorous that this was going on. So based on that, I wrote an article that I published in the journal American Anthropologist about the human-dog relationship and what I saw there. And the reason it gets political is because they have a particular relationship with dogs. And I was able to compare with other villages that I'd worked in. And the basic thing is that they go hunting with dogs. They have a trusted relationship, usually with one dog. They go hunting with their hunting dog. And if they have, over their lifetime, done the rituals properly according to Gaia, So they've done the pig sacrifices that they're supposed to do, just, and had proper behavior and so forth. And the ancestors reward them with boars.
Right.
So, and I asked them that, what does this mean? And they, you know, the people would say, well, it's, you know, we make these pig sacrifices, and in exchange, the ancestors give us boars. Now, of course, it's part of a bigger complex than that. But that's basically what it is. And the dogs choose their own reproductive partners, and they have their own lives. And they would describe that they have people that they're, other dog people that they're friends with, right? And other dogs that they're not friends with. And they know, you know, where to go, where not to go. They go hunting, and then the hunter and the dog, they'll take a different road coming back down the mountain. And they all know exactly where they're supposed to go. So they're sentient beings. You know, this is why I call it animism. But then there was an event while I was there, which was tragic. It was really traumatic. That one morning I woke up and went to the breakfast place as normal. People were crying because somebody had poisoned the dogs. Not all of them. And some of the dogs sensed the poison in the meat because somebody had strewn poisoned meat through the village. And some of the dogs ate it. Some of the dogs, they said, know which plant to eat as an antidote to poison. So they're assuming there's medical knowledge among dogs, which is also an old myth, an old story that they have, that dogs brought medicine to humankind. So, you know, this tragic event happened, and people were speculating about who could it be. And that was in the year 2013. It's still going on, and they still don't know who's doing it. And back then, they thought it must be the garbage collectors. And now they don't think it's the garbage collectors. Now they're actually suspecting it's one of their own.
Right.
And so the thing is, there's a political thing because, you know, it's an identity that they have. The overarching argument of the article, I think, is that in this colonial framework that they're in, they have their way of living with other creatures. And then the government comes in with their modernization ideas. And that means that they want them to keep their dogs tied up and at home all the time, no exceptions.
Yes.
And they expect them to have chips.
Right.
Yeah. You know, because I asked them, I said, well, you know, your dog was killed. Why don't you go to report this to the police? Oh, we can't do that because we're illegal ourselves. We haven't registered our dog. We don't have the chips. Right. And so the state has imposed this new model of living with animals on them. And that's the big political issue in Taiwan.
Which is interesting because that, for someone who was to follow issues about indigenous hunting and things. What we would hear about is the guns.
Right.
That's like the famous
thing
where you know, they get regulated, they're not allowed to have a certain level of weaponry, they have to build their own rifles. But we don't hear about the dogs.
Right.
Yeah. But actually, like we say, that's probably much closer to a whole way of life and influencing every day than the gun issue.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. I think that what's happening is there's a generational shift happening. But hunting was long embedded in this particular cosmology, a way of living in the world, which is different in all the different groups, you know. And I can't even say that the Sedek and Durugu have their own because there are different villages that have their own histories and their own migration paths, and it's going to be different. But what's happening now, as I look back, and this is 2024 and I talk to people now, is that the generation of people who hunted with their dogs, which often meant going and inspecting their traps with a dog who would accompany them.
Yeah.
Those people are now gradually passing on. Some of them are unable to walk as far as they could. And so there's a generational shift going on. And so now what we have are younger people who don't have the really interest to get animals by trapping. Trapping gives you the obligation to go back the next day and see if there's an animal in your trap, right?
Yes.
And if somebody has a job that they have to go to the next day, they're not going to do that.
Sure.
And so they prefer to hunt with rifles. And the hunters that I worked with, I was one in particular, he had his hunting territory that belonged to his clan. And I went with him and, you know, helped him out as he was cutting vegetation and so forth. And then these younger ones would come and negotiate with him about being able to use the same paths to go shoot flying squirrels. And so there was this going on. But now that older person is gone. And so we have younger people who would rather drive somewhere.
Right.
And they're not going to go on a hike up in the mountain that might take a day or two to have a, you know, their all trapping line, but rather they like to hunt someplace that's within a few hours at most from the road. And sometimes even right along the side of the road. And they do that with rifles instead of with traps. So there's a change going on.
Yeah.
And I think that the role of the dog, there's an emotional idea of the hunting dog.
Mm.
And I know that these young people do like to take a dog with them when they go hunting sometimes.
Right.
But it's not exactly the same relationship. So things are changing.
Yeah. It's a really interesting dilemma that you're describing. When you see these kind of generational shifts and it really impacts on long traditions. You know, from one side, you can look at it and you can say a lot of that is because of colonial regulations and kind of the changes that are being forced on these communities. And then from the other side, you get the argument, I know Trevor Reed mentions about the right to let culture die, making sure that it's the people themselves who decide what traditions they want to live on and what to let go of. And how do you balance that? I mean, do you have any stories you've seen or examples you could give of perhaps that complexity of those two sides colliding together?
Yeah, I think that gets into a rather different area of inquiry that I've done other than this ethnographic work.
Sure.
Because I have a whole series of articles that I've done more on human rights and on indigenous rights.
Yeah.
And I've often written with Siddiq lawyer Avi Mona, who teaches law at NDHU.
Yes.
So that kind of gets us into a different area. And our approach to this is that each of these indigenous peoples is inherently a small nation in becoming. And they have an inherent right, international law, to some form of sovereignty. Now that does not mean that they're going to establish a state. We're not talking about that. But they have a right to sovereignty. And that's something that's in international law. And it's a word, inherent sovereignty, that or natural sovereignty, that was picked up in Taiwan. In 1997, the Constitution was revised to recognizing political rights of indigenous peoples with the S, which then led to promises by presidential candidate Tsun Sui-bian that he would recognize their sovereignty. And then the Basic Law on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which kind of waters it down a bit and talks about creating some kind of self-government. And so there's a whole body of literature on that, which we deal with. Some of it comes from Canada, but we have been using that as our framework to look at. And so ideally, at some time in the near future, the institutions would be created in which each indigenous people or nation would be recognized as a legal person.
Okay.
And I think that's a compromise in a way, but as a legal person, they would have the right to determine their membership roles, for example, which is a big issue.
Okay. Yeah.
They would have the right to delineate and govern their hunting territories, which is another big issue.
Yeah.
If a company wished to go into their territory and mine or open a gas station, any kind of development, they would have to have the permission of the band council.
Right. Okay. Which doesn't happen.
Which doesn't happen. So it does happen in other countries, but it doesn't happen in Taiwan yet. So the idea is that they would have to be some kind of a legal person. You know, the reason I say that is because Taiwan is Republic of China. It's influenced by French civil law. They like the idea that everybody is equal in front of the law. So I think that it's probably instructive to look at the case of French Guiana, which is part of overseas France, which allows them to register as associations under a French law. And then therefore they are legal persons with the right to sign and enter into contracts.
Right.
And if Taiwan were to go in that modest pathway, then, and the indigenous peoples would have to determine themselves, are they going to be 16 of these peoples like they currently are recognized by the government, or do they have other forms of identity that are more important to them? Which I think is the case for the Sedjek Turuku. Okay. Right? And Sejik Tikataya and Dora, there are three different groups that they call themselves Sejik, different pronunciations. But in those groups that I work with, I think that putting them under one umbrella group, which is basically a confederation, is difficult. They've got two confederations now. I don't know if that would hold if they had this opportunity to be recognized as a legal person.
Okay. Do you see potential for progress in this area? Like, how possible is it?
Well, the thing is that it's already in the law. The basic law says it should happen.
Yeah.
So the struggle has actually been to have a law of self-government. And then there's law for traditional territories, all kinds of laws that have to be written because, again, it's civil law. So you get your basic law.
Yeah.
And things come from that. And so far, the cultural things have gone more rapidly because they're less threatening.
Yeah.
But things like self-government, that frightens some people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it hasn't successfully gone through the legislative yet. And I think that with the DPP in charge of the executive and the KMT having the majority with Phil Winslow's party, the chances of it getting through in the next few years, I think, are rather slim.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the KMT likes to focus on economic development instead.
Yeah.
And frankly, a lot of Indigenous people like that more than self-government.
Okay. Yeah. Which is interesting, but is that, in that sense, is that at a head with some of the Gaia that you were talking about before? Because I know you have mentioned how the idea of having economic growth, you have to keep growing, you can't have shrink,
right,
as being at odds with some of the indigenous Gaia, how to actually sustain the place that you live in.
Right. So if we read the books that are written by the indigenous authors that I was working with when I write that book, the argument is basically that Gaia was a way of sustainably managing the island for millennia before the colonial period.
Yeah.
And they basically say that the basis of Gaia is the alang, or the community. You have responsibilities to your alang, your kin-based community. You should share. So you go hunting, you come back, and you share the meat with the members of your alang. And of course, your family is part of that alang. It probably gets more meat. But you share, and you don't take more than you need. And I see that Gaia, just like most laws, are observed mostly in the breach. And so I see that Gaia expresses itself when somebody earns a lot of money and they got a nice house and a nice car, and then other people in the same village say, look at that one there. He's enriched himself at our expense, and that's a violation of Gaia.
Okay.
Or, you know, like the guy who was head of the township and then his wife had some disease and became handicapped. And they say the ancestors were punishing them for his greed because when he was in charge of the township, he knew an industrial park would be created. He put some land under his name and made a fortune. And so all of these rumors go on that are ways of people thinking through Gaia and saying other people have violated Gaia. So that is there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess inevitably the everyday life can sometimes be different.
Right, it can. And the thing is that because these are modern people in the year 2024, there are also large numbers of people who just say, well, you know, I want to work for that mine.
Mm.
I want to cut down that forest and grow tea. And so the Gaia doesn't necessarily lead to the kind of sustainable management of the forest that it did in the past.
Mm. Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, Scott, maybe I guess coming into land a little bit, how would you say your books and your research on that's related to that one? How does that contribute to the field of Taiwan studies as a discipline?
Yeah, I would hope that they can contribute to understanding the richness, the tapestry of Taiwan, but not as multicultural Taiwan. I want to be a little bit critical of that.
Okay.
I think that in the past, you know, when I was just joining this community of Taiwan studies, the mainstream idea in anthropology was that we're going to Taiwan to study Chinese culture.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there was a book by Hong and Murray saying that these anthropologists, they're looking through Taiwan in order to see China.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And So they used, you know, the Edward Said and all these things, you know, to talk about that. And I think that those arguments are correct. But I think that there's a risk that the same thing happens in Taiwan studies.
Okay.
And so there's this notion that we're studying democratic and multicultural Taiwan, and that's all wonderful. Without seeing that within that, there are peoples that have very different cosmologies, very different ontologies, very different ways of living in the world. And they don't necessarily agree with this democratic and multicultural Taiwan stuff. They don't want to be necessarily trapped in somebody else's model of multiculturalism.
Sure.
And they definitely don't like Taiwanese nationalism.
Yeah.
And we can see that in the voting patterns, because they consistently, the DPP is making inroads. There are now, you know, there's two indigenous roles. There's the plains and the mountain indigenous. They have, I believe, two representatives. I follow the mountain one. But nonetheless, the overarching tendency is at the level of legislative elections and also township and village elections that they really dislike Taiwanese nationalism. They don't like those Hoklo people with their ethnic nationalism. And so I think that Taiwan studies needs to be self-reflective and self-critical and think about that. And see it as a network of places, a meshwork of places, and that there's a lot of contestation and division within that.
Yeah, that's fascinating. With your kind of Canadian and Taiwanese perspective, I guess you get two very different views of the way that colonialism has impacted on indigenous communities, and how that's been handled, and good and bad ways it's tried to be addressed over the years. And I guess, do you see, therefore, in that sense, a lot of your research on Taiwan, while it could be part of the Taiwan studies field, but it also has contribution to the international arena, as it were, in terms of that.
Yeah, that's why the two books that I've written about indigenous Taiwan, the first one I published in a collection called Monde Autochtone, Indigenous Worlds, at the University of Laval Press in Quebec. And then the second one is at the University of Toronto and Ethnographic Horizons. But I wanted that to be read by people who do indigenous studies in Canada as well, not just in Taiwan.
Yeah.
And so I hope that it provides a needed non-Western example.
Right.
It's difficult, because there are some people in academia who refuse to see that there has been and is a form of non-Western colonialism. Okay. It's not just about Christopher Columbus in 1492 started white people going around the planet oppressing people, that there are other dynamics that happened.
Yeah.
And so they don't have the knowledge, but and it's not everybody, but it's, so I think it's important that I can show this with really fine-grained ethnography that's historically informed.
Sure.
And to let people know that, you know, the Qing dynasty was a colonial power.
Yes.
And Japan was a colonial power. In a way, there's second-order colonialism, because they were expanding in the way that they did because they felt they had to compete with the Western powers, right? But it is nonetheless another form of colonialism that's there, and it still affects people's lives today.
Yeah.
And so they are in an ongoing situation of colonialism, just like indigenous peoples in Canada.
Sure.
And so, yeah, there's definitely a Canadian spin to those two books.
Yes. I think that's really important to remember as well, that, you know, Taiwan studies is not inward looking.
Yeah, I think that Taiwan, the study of Taiwan and just the meshwork of lives here, it has a lot to teach us about the nature of the global system that we're in. And I think that it addresses some of the, you know, the big picture that some people like to draw, and it provides a richer and more nuanced perspective on that.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Scott.
Yeah.
It's been a real pleasure to hang out and to have this discussion. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
So that was Professor Scott Simon from the University of Ottawa in Canada, right here with us in Taipei. Don't forget to tune into our next episode, which will be coming up in around about 1 month's time. Also, please do subscribe to the International Taiwan Studies Center newsletter, which you can find the link in the description notes of this show. Get in touch with us if you've got any feedback as well. We'd love to hear from you. If there's questions that you've got about Taiwan studies or a certain field, or people that you'd like to hear on the program, then give us your opinion, give us your feedback. We love to hear it. Until next time, goodbye.